listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This is Tom Williams. My guest today is from the company of Looking Glass Theater, who has recently mounted The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens, which is a terrific play. And our guest today, Raymond Fox, wears several hats in the show. Hello, Raymond.
Hello.
How you doing today?
I'm all right. How are you?
The show is great.
Oh, thank you.
And tell us about how you got involved, because besides being one of the stars of the play, you are the person that came up with the concept and were one of the adapters.
Yes, I and Laura Eason and Heidi Stillman, who are fellow ensemble members, worked on the final script, and I was the person who first came to the company with the idea of adapting the novel into a play. And then shortly thereafter worked with the director, Tracy Walsh, on the project.
All right, what got you,
for a number of years.
What got you interested in doing The Old Curiosity Shop?
Well, as ensemble members at Looking Glass, even those of us who are not, most of us came to the company primarily as actors, but we're all encouraged to contribute as creators as well. We do almost entirely world premieres in the company, and the vast majority of those premieres are generated from within the company itself, either as original plays or adaptations of works from other sources. And Heidi Stillman had done a production, a very successful production of Hard Time, and I had worked on that show as an actor. And Dickens has always been my favorite author since I was in high school, and I think I've read all of his books but one. Now I'm saving one, all of his novels. And I thought that his work was particularly suited to Looking Glass because of its scope and so many characters and the themes he addresses. And so I had approached Heidi with specifically the idea of The Old Curiosity Shop in mind, because Hard Times, as you may remember, used a lot of circus, literally and metaphorically, to tell the story, which is something that a lot of members of our company have advanced skills in that regard. And The Old Curiosity Shop, although there isn't a formal circus in the production, there's a waxworks show, and there are giants and dwarves and a Punch and Judy proprietors who come through the narrative, and it's very, very imaginative in that way. Many, many, many characters, and it also has this weird sort of almost fantasy backdrop to the story of this young girl and all the characters she meets. It's almost as though if Dickens had written The Wizard of Oz, this would be the closest thing to that. And so I thought that that would appeal to the company. So I approached Heidi, and she was busy working on other projects at the time, but she was very excited about the book. And I was working on a play in New York and had a lot of extra time, and so I thought, well, I'll take a stab at this. And then that was now 4.5 years ago. And so that's how it started. And Tracy Walsh, who she and I had encountered the book ourselves about together 18 years ago, we took a course on Dickens at Northwestern when we were seniors as undergrads. And she and I and Laura Eason was also in that class. And The Old Curiosity Shop was among the books that we read. And Tracy had actually written in the margins of her copy, this would make a great play. So it was something that from that standpoint, I think had a long kind of genesis in the back of all of our minds. So that's how it began.
That's a heck of a story. And that teacher should be proud of doing a good job on Dickens.
Yes,
he certainly got you guys into
Chris
it.
Herbert. I think he might still, I'm not sure if he's still teaching at Northwestern or not, but it was a great course, and we all just loved that book so much.
So you were one of the you got this thing started, and you did a lot of the writing.
Yes, I did the very first draft on my own, which was very, very long. We originally had envisioned it being two plays. And that's how it remained in development for the first few years. So I did a first draft that was never meant to be something that would be performed, but just taking out anything that I thought could conceivably work on stage with, you know, 11 or 12 actors playing multiple roles.
I think there's something to having an actor of your experience doing an adaptation, because it certainly was so organized with all the characters that were going on. It was a very easy play to follow.
Oh, that's great.
And I'll tell you what, I could just see a play like this getting so complicated that you would just lose the audience, but not the way you guys presented it. So I think it has a lot to do with that ensemble where you guys are all, everybody's involved in everything.
Yes, and that, you know, and in terms of the other creators, they were, you know, it really is a group effort. Again, Laura Eason and Heidi Stillman were able to go through with the final draft and see places where we could remove three additional characters that, you know, were, although they were great, it just would have made that very even more confusing. And they were very creative in terms of altering some of the novel's trajectory and changing the relationships of some of the characters from what they are in the book so that we could do it with a smaller number of characters. But even so, I think we have 27 or 28 speaking characters that appear maybe in the show.
Yeah, it's got to be at least that many.
Actors.
Yeah, and there's only 10 actors. Wow.
Right.
Well, who came up with the set? Because I love the way it was backlit and the long set with the arch that's like a bridge and, you know, it's a couple levels. I thought that worked very, very well.
Yes, Brian Sidney Bembridge, who's one of he's a Looking Glass associate as well. He designed the set and he also did the lights for Hard Times. So he'd worked, of course, with the company on a number of productions, but specifically on Dickens with us before. And so he designed the set in consultation with Tracy. She had a basic idea, and then the two of them worked over about a year, I guess, to figure out what would be the best environment that could be so many different locations and that would hopefully thematically capture the scope of the play. And they also decided on what configuration the theater would be in and all of that. And then T.J. Gerkins, who is a lighting designer who often works with Mary Zimmerman, Tracy and I know, we had him come in from Cincinnati to do the lighting design, and Mara Blumenfeld, the fellow ensemble member, did all the amazing costumes, and many of those she designed from the ground up, which was just extraordinary. Three of those designers, we just got the best people we possibly could, and we're so grateful for that.
Well, you know, when you had the way some of those still shots went well with the people up on the bridge, and it reminded me of the illustrations that were usually in the Dickens novels.
Yes.
And that was such a clever and effective way of bringing us, engaging us. Anyone who's read Dickens who saw those illustrations, as soon as they see that, it instantly draws you into the show.
Oh, that's exactly what Tracy wanted to do, and that was all her vision, getting all that up there. And it is just, I'm unfortunately on stage when a lot of that's happening, but I have ducked out a few times, stood back and...
And Thomas Cox is as the villain with the bow-legged bit. I mean, that is amazing.
He's just, yes, he's really the only one we thought of that could do that part, and he's so perfect, and we're just so glad. We're so glad for all of the actors that we have in the show.
Yeah, name some of them. I mean, I liked the girl that played Nell.
Yes, Lori Hamm, who is somewhat new to Chicago. She's lived here for a year or two, but I think this is her first sort of... production that she's done with a large theater company, and that was the thing that we had the most concern about, was finding someone to play that role that you could that you would really feel something for. On the page, the character is so idealized and so sentimentalized, and we just wanted it to be, you know, this young girl who is there to help her grandfather, and that people could hopefully identify with and just be a kind, good, capable person. And Lori really came in to the audition, and within about a minute, she just sort of lit up the room, but she felt like she had some backbone, too.
Oh, yeah, she's got a little feistiness to her, which helps, yes.
And yes, which we felt we really needed, especially with a show that's under 2.5 hours.
Yeah, give us a little quick plot summary for those listeners who don't know the show.
Yes. Well, in the novel and in the show, it's the story of a young girl, Nell Trent, who lives with her grandfather in a sort of a rundown curiosity shop in London in 1839-1840. And her grandfather is her sole caretaker. And a curiosity shop is sort of a cross between an antique shop and a junk shop. And Nell is on some mysterious errand in the middle of the night, late in the evening, and she runs into a gentleman who's just walking the streets of London. And he takes her home and is very concerned that she's living in this environment, and that the grandfather then goes out into the night on another errand, and then the gentleman leaves, and you meet Mr. Quilp, who is a moneylender that the grandfather is indebted to. And Quilp, for reasons that don't become clear at first, realizes that he believes that the grandfather is hoarding large sums of money. What is in fact happening is that the grandfather is gambling all this money away, ostensibly so that he can give the money to Nell later. That he's going to protect her by allowing her to live in riches when he passes away, etc., etc. And then the rest of the story involves Nell or Quilp taking over the shop because he finds out that the money's being thwarted by the grandfather. Nell and her grandfather escaping from Quilp, who wants to possess them as much as he wants to possess the shop. And the grandfather, of course, is afraid he's going to be thrown into debtor's prison and separated from Nell. And then they flee to the countryside. And the single gentleman returns to the shop, and you don't know why he's suddenly so interested in these two. But it's almost a pursuit then, a parallel pursuit by both Quilp and the single gentleman through the rest of the play. And all these characters that Nell and the grandfather meet until there's this reconciliation.
And that's what makes the play work so well is the way you guys weave in and out all is this terrific crew of zany and wacko characters that Dickens was so great at inventing. I mean, I just thought it was amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. We're having so much fun doing it, and we've been lucky so far in having fairly full houses every night, and hopefully that will continue through the run.
Well, you know, there's an audience for great entertainment like this, and I don't know of another company than Looking Glass that can take on a project like this and really make it work. I mean, this thing just flowed. It's funny. I mean, the decision to have each character, I guess, I know you play multiple characters, as most of the ensemble does, but they don't hold back. If they have a character that has one little scene and is supposed to add a little humor, boy, they really go for it.
Yes, well, and we were greatly helped in that sort of delineation by Eva Brenneman, who plays Mrs. Ginawan and Mrs. Jarley, and is also the dialect coach for the production. And because the narrative goes all over England, and Dickens doesn't specify exact place names for the towns once they get out of London, Eva was very, very helpful in terms of saying, okay, we're going to imagine that at this point Nell and the grandfather are in the south of England. At this point they probably travel to the north of England. And so she would work with each character, even if you only had four or five lines, to help get you a slightly different regional dialect, a slightly different pitch of your voice, so that hopefully, you know, the audience would feel as though they were taking that journey as well, and that even though there are only 10 of us, that there was the illusion that the stage was going to be populated by a cast of 20 or more.
Well, I can tell you that it really did work because I was able to hear many of the well-known English accents.
Oh, good.
And the humor. I mean, this play is amazingly funny. It adds, the humor is terrific, yet it carries its point very
that's
strong.
That's great. And that's what I felt and Tracy felt as well, is that it has some of the funniest writing that Dickens ever did. It has some of the most moving writing that he ever did. But it was a fairly early novel in his career. There are things about it that, you know, it's not the strongest book overall that he ever wrote. But we both felt that it was somewhat undiscovered, and that it's something that's also rarely adapted for the stage. And that was something that I was very interested in doing, because as much as I love Dickens, I feel that, you know, there are a few books that people always see again and again and again, and it's understandable that you would see David Copperfield, Great Expectations, The Christmas Carol, of course, even Hard Times to a degree. And I thought, well, this is one that I think is going to be undiscovered for a lot of people in the audience, and hopefully the production will draw people back to the book, and it addresses things in a different way than many of his other works. And so I was very excited to to work on it with everyone at the company, and I'm just couldn't be happier that people are enjoying it.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't know the story, just a little bit. I think I'd read a synopsis of it one time or another, but I'll tell you, it definitely gets you interested in going back and reading Dickens, and because you guys brought out the rich characters and the bizarre human traits. I mean, you can go from funny to evil. I mean, Cox's character, to a certain extent, he was almost a cartoon character, and then you really see how nasty he really was.
Oh, yes. Well, and in the book, the character is, he's almost supernatural. I mean, he's actually a dwarf in the novel.
Okay.
But he's described as having the head of a giant. Dickens talks about him being bizarre and monkey-like. There's almost a suggestion that he's able to walk through walls. You get the sense that he has this almost phantom-like ability. And so even though, you know, obviously we weren't going to have an actor who's necessarily short of stature, we wanted it to be very, someone who was very protean, someone who could change in his technique, and that he would be charmingly evil, but also joyously evil, which I think Tom brings out. He speaks a different way to Nell than he will to the grandfather, than he will, and his just physicality, which was the other thing Tracy said, is that the silhouette of Quilp should be something bizarre and strange, and Tom is just extraordinary that way.
And his discipline, his physical discipline, to be able to maintain that throughout the show.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, and then he drops it all to play Mr. Martin, who's the very kind schoolmaster that Nell and the grandfather meet.
I'll tell you how good he was in that. It took me a while to figure out who that was. Then I go, that's Cox.
Yep.
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, you play several roles, too. You're the narrator of this. You're kind of the anchor of the show.
Yes. Which is a lot of fun, and my wife is about to have our first child any day now. So some of it was conscious that I would play that role because I was going to be off stage a little more than not. But then we kept having these other little bit parts, and Tracy said, "Well, there's no one else to do it." So I end up sort of popping in here and there. But it is fun to sort of be the person to bookend the show that way in narration, to also as the narrator, to figure in as a character.
And you know, it's so great the way you guys structured it, where you come out and do that postmortem on what happens to everybody at the end. Because so many of these shows, you love the characters, and then you kind of wonder, well, geez, what happened to them?
Yes, and I love that. That's exactly the way the book ends. And that we changed very little in that text. That's almost exactly the way it is in the book. We obviously just discussed the characters that we kept for the narrative, but that's the last paragraph that I speak is the last paragraph of the novel. And I think Dickens ends the novel in a beautiful way, too, sort of with the idea that all our lives are just a story, and as long as that story is retold, that's how we stay alive. That's all we have is our memories.
How true that is. Let me ask you this from an actor's point of view. How do you and the other cast members, you go off stage, you finish the scene, you got a race to get into the next outfit or whatever you're going to do to come back on stage. How do you keep that going each night and make it fresh?
Well, the very thing that you mentioned in some regard does keep it fresh because there's no time to rest. I don't think anyone has time to go up and sit in the dressing room or take a break. We have Jennifer Edwards, who is our wardrobe master. She's there to help us get in and out of costume, and we have a running sheet. And I think also with playing so many characters, you try to get into the mindset of the next person when you come off stage. And the clothes, Mara Blumenfeld's costumes, you know, whatever you're wearing, sort of, as any actor will tell you, the way you move in that garb helps inform the character and what you do, and it's just, we all, I think, feel like we're shot out of a cannon a little bit when the play starts.
Well, I'll tell you, the stage manager has a heck of a job in this show. Huh?
Yes. Well, she's terrific.
Who is the stage manager?
Sarah Gemitter, who is our sort of our in-house Looking Glass stage manager.
You know, they don't get enough recognition for what they do in it. Of course, if the show goes the way it should, you don't even know they're there.
No. And she keeps everything running beautifully every night. She's just, you know, we've had her Thank heaven for Sarah. We've had her for years. She knows us all and keeps everyone calm and keeps everything running smoothly. And we couldn't do it without her. And she and Jonathan Templeton, who's the assistant stage manager, really run a sort of an elegant ship. So that's great.
Well, I think this is a heck of a debut directing for your director.
For Tracy.
For Tracy, yes.
She's just done such an extraordinary job, and I hope and I'm sure it will be the start of a great parallel career for her as a director. And she's worked for many years as an actor and choreographer.
Oh, yes.
And she was the assistant director to Heidi Stillman on all the productions of Hard Times. She's assisted on several other productions, and she's had such a passion for this piece in particular. She and I have worked together on it for about 3 years, and she did a lot of work in the middle stages of the script, and it's just been great for me to be able to sit back and watch her bring it to life.
One of the things that I really thought was effective is the transitions.
Yes.
On this long stage where you got to bring all these different characters and maybe a different time or trying to figure out where it is, the way she used the little transitions, a little scene with maybe one or two persons or one slowly leaving while the next thing gets going, just added so much to it because it just kept it flowing.
Right, and that's something I think we've gotten fairly good at Looking Glass. You know, that's something I think we all learned from Mary Zimmerman especially, is that the play never stops. That if you have to do any kind of scenic change, you want to have that sleight of hand where the story is still going on, and especially when you're looking at something like Dickens or a lot of the other more epic works that we adapt, there are long, long passages of narrative that you need to sort of elide visually so as not to take up a tremendous amount of time with text on stage. So anywhere that we felt that we could tell part of the story in the transition visually, you know, we'll go ahead and use that.
Well, I wish more directors would come see your guys' work to learn to do that. But you guys have that down to a science.
Well, yes. Well, that's good to hear. It takes a lot of work in during our technical weeks of rehearsal. And, you know, that's something where everyone's input really does come to the fore and really, really does help us. And especially in this story, because there are so many times in the novel where person A doesn't know something that person B knows, and so then they have to tell person C, and I just wanted to make sure that we weren't telling the audience something they already knew. But if you see a visual interaction between two characters, and you know, okay, now Kit knows this thing that, you know, whatever it is, then that's a nice shorthand.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can do it in a beautiful and engaging way so that the play doesn't hit pause.
Well, not only where they're doing it, so you're setting up the next scene, but the way the lighting works in this really adds to it. I mean, so you guys did a lot of storytelling without words.
Well, that's great. I mean, that is our intent. So that's always gratifying to hear when we can be sure that's working the way that it's supposed to.
Well, in the interest of time, now give us a little bit of your background, because I've always said you're one of the A-list actors in Chicago. Tell us some of the shows you're most proud to have been in the last few years.
In Chicago, I did about 10 years ago, I did a season at Stratford in Canada as part of the Chicago Exchange that they have. So I was in the young company there, and that was a really great time. I think probably the thing I'm most known for is I was in Mary Zimmerman's original production of Metamorphoses in Chicago, and then toured that all over the country and did the original off-Broadway and Broadway productions of that show. So that was obviously a huge...
Being in a Tony Award-winning show is not a bad idea.
No.
Good career move.
So that was great, and I was in that show off and on for about 6 years, which is an extraordinary thing. Some of my favorite shows, I've done three shows now with Remy Bumpo, which is another company in Chicago, and I always love working with them. Money, particularly, which is an Edward Bulwer-Lytton play, which isn't very well known, was one of my favorites. I did Arcadia in Detroit several years ago. It was great fun. So I'm always, I think like most actors, I'm always trying to find as much variety as I can. But I've been very, very lucky, and so much of that is due to to just being in Chicago, both as a student and then as a professional actor.
So you would consider yourself more of a classical actor?
Well, I think that's where a little most of my training lies. I kind of ended up in Looking Glass by accident in some ways, even though I've been working with the company off and on for about 17 years. I ended up doing a show with them in their first season in 1989. But I was my interest was more sort of in the classical, traditional theater route. And then I went away to graduate school in the early 90s in Boston and lived in New York for a year and then was visiting Chicago for a weekend. And my great friend Phil Smith said, you know, Bruce Norris is going to be directing this adaptation of Up Against It, the Joe Orton play, for us this summer. Do you want to stay an extra day and audition? And I did, and did the show, and then kept getting called back to Chicago for various things, and eventually joined the company. But have always kept my hand in trying to do a little Shakespeare, a little Shaw, a little, you know, more traditional classical theater as well as contemporary theater elsewhere. But certainly I'm so grateful that I ended up in Looking Glass and as an ensemble member for the last 9 years. So they've really pushed me to do a lot of things that I would never have done if I had just stayed on the course that I...
It sure helps being with a group of creative souls like Looking Glass.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary now to be working with the same people for going on 20 years. And to have that shorthand with the group of actors and to have that home to come back to all the time is really something very few people...
It's got to be fun to have your name under adapted by in a major play, isn't it?
It is. It's kind of crazy. Because I'm not necessarily embarking on that as something I don't know that I'll continue to do that or not. And again, it was, you know, to have Laura and Heidi help me so greatly with that, and Tracy too, and everyone was in, you know, it's always a group effort. It's always an ensemble approach to everything that we do. But I am proud that I brought this to the table, and that now it exists. Now it's out in the world, and that we actually did it. And so, you know, for having some part in getting it on the stage is a very... It's a great thing. And I did have that experience. You know, I do have the experience now where I'll be watching a scene on the monitor off stage and sort of running through the various ways that the scene went textually and then forgetting that I actually have to come on stage, which is a strange but a really nice thing to hear the words that you've helped to craft to be spoken.
All right, give us a little plug now for the show. It's... The title is The Old Curiosity Shop. I love the secondary title, Victorian Fairy Tale of Joy and Woe.
Oh, great. Yes, which we think really describes it. It took us a while to come up with that, but we think that does reflect what we're doing.
All right.
So we've had a lot of kids come to the show, too.
Yeah, what's the reaction of kids? Because to me, it's about maybe 12 and up. That's what I would assume, but you said kids, what, younger than that, right?
I think a little younger.
Yeah?
I mean, I would feel comfortable, especially if, you know, the kids, you know, are, if they're familiar with the theater. I've seen kids as young as 7 or 8, and they seem to be, you know, as wrapped with it as anyone else who's enjoying it. But I don't know if the box office, I think they have a target age that they would say, you know, this may be a little too scary for someone younger than this. This might be a little, you know, it might be a little too long for someone else. But it's been surprising. I would say about 8 or 9 years old, we've had quite a few kids in that age range come to the show, and they seem to really enjoy it.
Do you do any performances for the high schools, or do you have any of that going yet?
We do. We've had one student matinee already during the weekday afternoon, and I believe that the theater is still open to doing more. It just depends on if we have any schools contact our education department, and then if we can get enough students interested, my understanding is that we could add an additional Wednesday matinee performance.
Oh, good. I hope that happens, because I know Steppenwolf and Chicago Shakespeare are doing that, and they're attracting. They're getting the kids to find out it's cool and it's okay to like theater.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so I hope we do more for this show. And I know we're always we're always trying to bring in as many students as we can.
All right, so the show runs, what, Wednesdays?
Wednesdays through Sunday.
Sunday.
Wednesday night at 7:30, Thursday night at 6:30, Friday at 7:30, Saturday at 3 and at 8, and Sunday at 3.
I like the idea of the Thursday night at the 6:30.
Yes, that's been very popular.
Yeah, more people should do that during the week because, you know, some people say Thursday night's a tough night to get an audience. But I see the strategy here. Get them, a lot of people work downtown, and it's easy to get over to Chicago and Michigan Avenue. And that way they can get home at a decent hour.
Absolutely. Well, that's what we found, and I think we might even, I'm not sure exactly, but I think we might be doing one more evening of a 6:30 curtain starting next season, where I believe we're adding a Tuesday night as well. I think we're doing more performances per week than we have, which will be nice. But we try to balance it out to give people who want to do just as you say, get to the theater a little earlier, get home a little sooner, and certainly on Saturday night, if people are downtown and want to have a leisurely dinner first, keep the 8 o'clock curtain.
And the show runs through June 11th?
Through June 11th.
Okay, any chance of it being extended?
I think not, because our this season with the 5 shows, which is an expansion from our usual schedule, my understanding is that the show that follows us needs to get into the theater right away. So if you're interested in seeing the show, I would go ahead and buy tickets now, because I think even if we wanted to extend, my understanding is it's not likely that we would be able to.
Well, there's plenty of time for folks to get it, and I can tell you this is a tremendous show. It's totally different than most theater pieces you'd see, and it's just so well done, and you guys got to be really proud of this show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's so great to hear, and we are very happy with it. It's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much for the interview. I know you're busy, and I hope you have the wife delivers the child soon and a healthy. You've got to be excited about that, huh?
I'm very excited. I'm very excited about that. The hot, you know, we're having the baby apprentice, which is just 3 blocks from the theater. So hopefully, it happened, and I'm at work.
Do they have an understudy for you?
Yes. And he's been great. And he, of course, had to be ready early because there was the outside chance that, you know, we could have had the baby even in previews. So
wow.
But the due date is this Friday, so it could be any moment.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Raymond, for your time, and
well,
it's been a nice interview, and keep up the great work.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.